From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, 19 years in China's prison labor camps. We talk with Harry Wu. He was sentenced to life after he was denounced as a stinking intellectual and a bourgeois. Now he's a resident scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and a passionate critic of China's brutal penal system. We'll talk with him about his new memoir. Also today, the anger of the black middle class. We talk with Newsweek columnist Ellis Coase, author of a new book about why the black middle class is in pain in spite of its evident prosperity. And commentator Maureen Corrigan usually reviews books for us, but lately she's been reading car magazines. She'll tell us about her trip to an auto show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The nation's highest military court today chastised the Navy for its investigation of the tailhook scandal. The criticism came in a decision handed down in the case of a pilot who was seeking immunity. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
In exchange for his cooperation, Navy Lieutenant David Samples had been granted testimonial immunity, meaning he would not be prosecuted based on his testimony. Samples is charged with indecent assault on a woman at the 1991 Tailhook Convention. The aviator, however, argued that he had been promised immunity from all prosecution, but the military court ruled against Samples, clearing the way for a possible court-martial. In handing down the decision, however, the court criticized the Navy for a careless and amateurish approach to the case. At worst, said the court, it raises the possibility of a shadiness in the rights accorded to military members in a criminal investigation. The court said that Samples was caught up in an assembly line of investigative efforts involving about 20 officers that merged and blurred investigative and justice procedures. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
NATO has issued new threats to use force against Bosnian Serb troops. NATO says it is ready to use airstrikes to open up areas in Bosnia that are controlled by guerrilla fighters. But the Serbs have responded with threats of their own. A Bosnian Serb military commander says his forces always stay close to United Nations peacekeepers and that airstrikes would put them in as much danger as the Bosnian Serbs would be. He also claims such attacks would trigger a world war. Israel and PLO negotiators are denying earlier reports that said the two sides had reached an agreement on the size of a Palestinian self-ruled area around the West Bank town of Jericho. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
One Palestinian negotiator called the reports of an agreement on Jericho a complete fabrication, and an Israeli spokesman who was quoted as confirming that the enclave would be 22 square miles said his remarks had been misinterpreted. The confusion at the negotiations in the Egyptian resort of Taba was reminiscent of earlier talks in Cairo, when Israel claimed there was agreement on both the size of Jericho and the question of control of the borders into Jericho and the Gaza Strip, but the Palestinians denied there was such an agreement. Talks in Taba are continuing, and the head of the Palestinian delegation, Nabil Shaath, says there won't be any announcements on agreements until both sides are ready. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
30 years ago today, the Surgeon General issued the first of several warnings about tobacco smoking. Past Surgeons General are joining health groups today to ask the government to tighten control of tobacco sales and advertising. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 15 points at 3,850. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Croatian leaders have made a surprise offer to the Bosnian government. They're suggesting that the Bosnian government and Croatia join and make an economic union. This offer came at peace talks today in Germany. The surprise suggestion comes as Bosnian government troops are advancing on Bosnian Croats in the central part of the republic. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic says the offer is interesting, but it comes at a bad time. He's promising to respond to this suggestion by Saturday. Most Americans think high schools are ignoring the educational and training needs of students who don't go to college, according to a survey released today by the National Career Development Association. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The Gallup polling organization interviewed over 1,000 people ages 18 to 25 last fall. About 700 were working full or part-time, yet 6 out of 10 said high school did not provide the academic foundation, training, or counseling they needed. Those who had not intended to go to college felt they had been left to fend for themselves. In light of the extraordinary pace of change in the nation's job market, teenagers in the survey were less optimistic than those in their mid-20s about their future employment possibilities. They were also the most adamant about the need for apprenticeships and vocational technical education. Today's survey estimates that 72% of all working Americans are anxious about their career options, but not sure about the kind of retraining and education they need or where to get it. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
President Clinton says he's still not happy with the way the World Trade Agreement looks. He plans to work to get Europe to make more concessions. The president spoke with American business executives today in Brussels. He said he's not completely satisfied with the trade accord that was reached on December 15th. One point he highlighted is French limitations on American film and television products. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Harry Wu, survived 19 years in Chinese labor camps. His crimes were criticizing the Soviet invasion of Hungary, being an intellectual and a bourgeois. Wu grew up in Shanghai, part of the westernized upper middle class. His father was a bank executive and later owned a knitting yarn factory. Wu remembers with pride when his father bought a Westinghouse refrigerator and made a down payment on a Chevrolet in the summer of 1948, the last year of nationalist rule in Shanghai. Wu was arrested on the day after his college graduation and sentenced to life imprisonment, but he was released in 1979. He's lived in the U.S. since 1985 and is now a resident scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Wu writes about his long imprisonment in his new memoir, Bitter Wind. He says in his college days, he was apolitical. The only things on his mind were baseball and girls. But he was encouraged to give his opinions, so he did. After he was arrested, he was told to confess.
At the beginning, I don't quite understand what should I do, is what it means confess. And the police force may say, you have to admit your crime, and you have to make the confession to meet we have in our file. And you have to say, I'm sorry, I'm ready to accept the reform. And then they arrange to me go to the labor.
So did you confess to these so-called crimes?
I did. Because if you refuse to confess, refuse to admit, and if you say you are innocent, they right away torture you.
So what did you say when you confessed?
I say I'm a counter-revolutionary rightist. I'm enemy of the people, enemy of the party. And I have to reform myself into a new socialist people.
Now, were the labor camps that you were sent to supposed to reform you?
Yes. In Chinese labor camp, they have a very special function. They call thought reform, what you know as brainwashing. To create imagined guilty, humanity is the sore, force people to back on their knees and transfer them into unthinking robots. I had once been reduced to such a robot. I forgot my dignity, future, freedom, everything. I surrounded. I cooperated with the wardens, and I beat fellow prisoners. I stole food. I begged a guard's mercy at his feet while in the solid confinement. That's how I survived the camp. You know, the heroes cannot survive the camp, the system. They're physically crushed right away.
Well, your attitude was you would do whatever you needed to do to survive.
Yes. And I think the way is you have to turn yourself into a beast. That's the only way. If you're thinking you are human beings, then you are thinking about freedom, family, future, sex, right and wrong. And those things only cause suffering. And a hungry beast only thinking about grabbing food from anywhere. it's easy to survive.
You were in several different camps during your 19 years of imprisonment. What kind of labor were you forced to do?
I has been in 12 different labor camps. The first one is a chemical factory, 12 hours a day. And then they put me in the iron mine, and later as a brick factory, as a farm. And then I spent another 9 years in a coal mine. All of these primitive physical labor. The more important things in the camp is the police guard used the food to control the people.
They used food to control people?
Yeah. The police say, no labor, no food. You cannot complete your labor quota, reduce your food, remove away your food.
One of the ways you found to get a little bit of extra food was to look for rat holes, because where there was a rat hole, the rat might have stashed some grain, some corn. What was the best stash you ever found in a rat hole?
I still remember my very lucky times I found a rat horse. The rat is a very good collector. They collect same size, the soybean bean, they collect the rice, collect the corn, and in their hole, even you pour the water, you cannot damage the storage. If one day one of the prisoners can find a rat horse, then he become like a millionaire. You know, it's really good. And if we can cut the rats, and also we eat it.
And the rats too. So you ate rats.
I ate it. I ate a lot. And also the frogs, mm-hmm. snakes, mm-hmm. any kind of life.
When you would find food, would you try to share it with other people?
No, never.
Or was it's too important to survive?
No, never, yeah. Never. Never share with the other people. And always try to grab the people from other people. I did it many times. I beat in them and robbed their food. If I'm strong, I did.
Did people beat you and rob your food?
They did to me also.
Mm-hmm. When you were a prisoner, how often were you called on to confess again or to do what's called self-criticism?
This is routinely in the camp. Every week, they have a criticized meeting and pull out one of the inmates in a meeting to criticize. That means struggle meeting. It means punishment. And every prisoners every month have a thought summarized. They have to write a paper talking about your labor performance, reform performance, include your discipline, include how you cooperate with the government, and how you learn and study the Chairman Moore selection to make a self-criticism about your original crime.
If you confessed when you were asked to confess, and if you did the work that you were told to do, was there supposed to be hope that you would eventually be released?
No. No. The confess, the thought reform, only a kind to destroy your dignity, destroy your self-respect. Turn the people into a unthinking robot. That's it. But the Chinese communists quite understand if one day you become an enemy, if one day you get in the camp, forever you are the enemy. Because you realize you already experienced the horrible things and you would not never stand together with the communists, so that they never let you out.
How did you get out?
That happened in 1979, because Deng Xiaoping come to the power, and there's so many new counter-revolutionary in front of the communist regime, and most of these old people, like me, because this is 20 years ago, it's almost destroyed. Not many people survive. And they have to give the people a break, and they released most of these old prisoners.
So that's how you were released?
Yes.
When you were released, you went back to your home in Shanghai. Let's talk about what happened to your family. It turns out your mother, your stepmother, mm-hmm. had committed suicide shortly after you were imprisoned, mm-hmm. after she got your first letter. Mm-hmm. Do you know why she killed herself?
It's hard. Yes. My stepmother is my real mother because he came to me when I was 5 years old. He loves me. I really love her. So he gave a lot of hope on me. In 1960, even I already have a title as a counter-revolutionary writer, but he still expected me can graduate from the school and assign a job, and maybe something will be changed. But unfortunately, he received a letter. It's really a shock to him. He cannot accept it. And that's why no choice for her. He really scared and really disappointed. And he commits suicide. And I never know about it. My family not allowed to tell me about it. Because commit suicide in China also is a kind of crime, especially for these counter-revolutionary family. Suppose you are using the death to against the government. So they have to tell the police our mother was dead in a heart attack.
Because if they knew she had committed suicide after she got your letter, it would be seen as a criticism of the communist government?
Yes, and then these problem will come to the rest of my family.
Now, your father was denounced by members of his own family as a stinking reactionary. Who did that to him?
My sister. They have to.
She was forced to do it?
Forced. You have to. In China, if one person become a counter-revolutionary, all your friends and family have to stay away with you, make a clear separation with you. They should not sympathize you. They could not do that. If they sympathize you and stand with you, they also were sent to the camp. Sympathize the counter-revolutionary is also as a crime in China.
Now, one of your brothers became a communist. He expressed his love for Chairman Mao, but then he was attacked because of his reactionary family, and those blows left him mentally disabled. What happened to him?
My youngest brother didn't become a communist, but he is impossible for him to become a communist because his father, his brother, is a counter-revolutionary.
I see, so he couldn't become a communist.
But,
okay.
But she's really in his heart. He want to become a revolutionary. He really loved the chairman more. So he want to separate with the family and go to the countryside and so-called receive the re-education for the poor peasants. And he want to serve the people. And he got a job assignment in a far remote area, and he worked very hard. But one day, he found the portrait of Chairman Mao was dusty by someone. And it seems to him this is very bad things. So he report to the Red Guard and reported police, say maybe some people do something wrong to our great leader. And then the Red Guard and the police suspect maybe my brother did it. Because you come from the counter-revolutionary family. And and they handle him to the struggle meeting and beat him and damage the brain. And at the beginning, it seems to them, maybe my brother is trying to pose, trying to pretend like a mental disabled, you know. And finally they find it's true, it's because the brain was damaged and they just leave it away. So my brother went back to home and under my father's take care of by my father. Finally, my father was gone in 1980. Nobody can take care of him. And he have some kind of recovered at 1980-81. It's sometimes okay. And then he went to Beijing. He wanted to up visit the government and to request to have a job and request to have a rehabilitation. But unfortunately, the police arrested and beaten and tortured and to death.
So your brother is dead now?
Yeah, died in 1981.
Is your surviving family, your surviving brothers and sisters still in China?
Yes. I still have two sisters and two brothers still in China.
Do you think that they're in any danger with you speaking the way you are about China?
Well, you ought to know, since 1957, all my family is already in the trouble. They already denounced me and separated with me. And I don't think there's any big difference if I speak out. It's already happened many years ago.
Right. So you aren't even on speaking terms with them anymore?
No. We cannot communicate.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Harry Wu. His new memoir, Bitter Winds, is about his 19-year imprisonment in Chinese labor camps. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harry Wu. He now lives in the United States and is a resident scholar at the Hoover Institution. A couple of years ago, in 1991, you decided to go back to China to try to document the prison camp system there. And you took a hidden camera with you. You did this for 60 minutes, so they helped, I guess, equip you with mm-hmm. what you needed to take pictures and to take video. Mm-hmm. Why did you take the risk to go back to China and do that?
First of all, the pieces of land in the Asia we call China, that is my motherland. My parents, my brother, they're still over there. And many, many of my inmates, my friends, they're over there. I cannot stop thinking about them. The nightmares always come back to me. I'm lucky. I survive. I want to enjoy my life in a peaceful land. I'm a very normal person. I want to be loved. I want to love. But I cannot turn back on these people, these nameless, voiceless, faceless people. Forget means betray. I cannot do that.
Did you get the pictures that you wanted to?
Yes, I did.
Were there particular pictures you wanted to get?
Yes, I want to get the picture about the facility, about the prison labor, and also about forced labor products exporting. And I want to taping what these people tell me, include the policemen, include the prisoners.
Do you think that there are a lot of goods that are made by prisoners that are exported to other countries?
According to Chinese internal documents say, 40% of forced labor camp industrial product is for export. and there's countless agricultural products like meat, rice, tea, fruits. They say these is agricultural tradition export products, sell it to the foreign market.
The United States will be reconsidering China's most favored nation status. It's up for renewal this spring. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the president should extend most favored nation status to China?
President Clinton have an admission order as a condition of MFN. One of the major conditions is about slave labor, about forced labor. I don't think until today the Chinese meet the condition because the product is still continuing export, but just under some kind of cover. Okay. And both sides have signed a memorandum of understanding in 1992, August, to stop the forced labor products to export. And also Chinese government have to allow the American representative to visit the prison facility. But so far until today, United States requests to visit 5 facilities and 4 of them rejected, only allow visit 1, but they took the American people to the wrong place. When American asked to revisit, also rejected. But I like to emphasize the forced labor product issue is only one of the way to leading the people aware there's a camp system exists in China, in our human being society today. So, we knew about concentration camp, we knew about gulag, but we knew very little about lagai.
So do you think most favored nation status should be linked to improvements in human rights and to the end of prison labor products being exported?
We have to use the MFN, tell the Chinese autocracy, you need the money, you must make some improvement of human rights. And also this is a very good way to deliver the message to the common Chinese. Say we care the human rights. Just like the Olympic, 2000 Olympic issue. The Chinese people were thinking about why we didn't get the rights to host the 2000 Olympics because of the human rights abuse.
Do you feel that your years in the prison camp have left you with permanent physical or emotional damage?
Yes, sometimes I feel like that. Sometimes I always have some overprotect. Very sensitive to react to the other people because I'm very sensitive the people is going to, you know, hurt me or damage me, mm-hmm. or try to, you know, and overprotect. But I quite understand I'm living in a very peaceful country and the people are very nice, very kind. Mm-hmm. And so I really enjoy and I feel very good. And most of the favorite for me is I can think freely, I can speak freely.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Harry Wu's new memoir is called Bitter Winds. He's now a resident scholar at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, what many black middle-class Americans feel, but few whites understand. We talk with journalist Ellis Coase about how many African-American professionals still feel hampered by discrimination, although the assumption is they've got it made. Coase is contributing editor and essayist for Newsweek magazine and the author of The Rage of a Privileged Class. And commentator Maureen Corrigan finds herself in the male world of the auto show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The NATO threat of possible use of airstrikes was welcomed by United Nations peacekeeping forces in the former Yugoslavia today, but as the BBC's Paul Adams reports from Belgrade, it will not affect present operations.
A UN officer currently stationed outside Belgrade said the NATO decision might offer moral support, but would make no significant change to existing plans for the relief of Tuzla. He said that in recent days, UN forces had conducted air support exercises inside Bosnia using British, Italian, and German planes. He said that in many cases, the mere presence of powerful warplanes could make the difference between the success and failure of an operation. There had already been cases, he said, in which low-level overflights had persuaded reluctant local Serb commanders to allow convoys through. Later this week, the UN will embark on a fresh attempt to send 11 German-made Leopard tanks into Bosnia.
Paul Adams in Belgrade. At least five Democratic senators are calling for a special prosecutor to investigate President Clinton's investment in a controversial Arkansas real estate deal. They join several Republican lawmakers who've been calling for the special counsel since the matter first came to national attention. Investigators are trying to find out if depositors' funds in a failed Arkansas savings and loan were diverted to help retire Mr. Clinton's 1984 debt from his race for governor. They are also trying to find out if more funds were used to put into the Whitewater land development that the Clintons also invested in. The State Department has set forth a list of global issues that are facing the Clinton administration in 1994. UBI's Bill Small has this report.
State Department Counselor Tim Wirth laid out what he called a very ambitious global agenda for the Clinton administration in 1994. Its issues ranging from human rights to U.S. concern over world population growth to the environment and trade and to drug trafficking.
The flow of funds and the efforts made by our embassies, not only in the Andean area, but in Southeast Asia with the growing and very troubling problems of heroin, are going to get greater attention and, we hope, increasing support from the Congress.
Wirth says the next major event on the U.S. agenda is Mr. Clinton's meeting in February with Japanese Prime Minister Hosokawa. Bill Small, Washington.
30 years ago today, the Surgeon General released the first government report on the ill effects of smoking. Today, anti-tobacco activists want stronger action taken. The Coalition on Smoking or Health says smoking kills 420,000 people every year. But a spokesman for the Tobacco Institute says the industry is quite well regulated by several agencies and that some people enjoy smoking. On Wall Street, stocks fell today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 15 points to end at 3,850. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. State welfare officials are calling on the federal government to overhaul the nation's welfare system. The American Public Welfare Association, a bipartisan group made up of state and local welfare authorities, held a news conference today. They're proposing a five-year, $15 billion overhaul of aid programs to the poor. One key recommendation would require recipients of welfare to get jobs within 2 years if work, health care, and child care are available. The report also underscores the importance of working with local private employers. Authorities have begun searching the Adirondack Mountain region in upstate New York for the body of a girl from the Utica area who disappeared last August. Chris Ulanowski, a member station WRVO, reports.
12-year-old Sarah Ann Wood disappeared while she was riding her bicycle home from her father's church. State police allege a Massachusetts man facing attempted kidnapping and murder charges in two separate cases involving children is responsible. New York State Police say 43-year-old Lewis Lent Jr. gave information to investigators, leading searchers to Racket Lake, where they're looking for Sarah's body. State Police spokesman Jim Simpson says the search is going slowly.
Unfortunately, we're up against it with some severe weather. We've got 3 feet of snow on the ground, and we don't have an exact location. We just have a very vague recollection by Mr. Lent.
Investigators are attempting to establish any links that might exist between Lent and the disappearance and murder of other children in the Northeast. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Shalinowski in Oswego, New York.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin says he's willing to cooperate with opponents in the new Russian parliament. The upper and lower chambers were seated today. Yeltsin spoke to the opening session of the upper parliament. He's urging lawmakers to drop their ideologies and work for the good of the country. Communist and ultranationalists hold more seats in the upper chamber than Yeltsin supporters do. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ellis Coase has written a new book about something many white people aren't aware of, the anger and pain of the black middle class. He says that despite its evident prosperity, the black middle class is in excruciating pain. Coase's new book is called The Rage of a Privileged Class. He's a contributing editor and essayist at Newsweek and former editorial page editor of the New York Daily News. Coase says many African-American professionals feel betrayed by a broken covenant.
The agreement that these people thought they had with their corporations and with their country, that if they went to the right schools, they worked hard, they did the best of their ability to achieve, they would be allowed to achieve, at least to the extent of their expertise, their abilities, and their effort. And what a number of middle-class black Americans have discovered is that this seems to apply to them less than it applies to many of their white colleagues.
Do a lot of black middle-class people feel that their progress is being cut off?
They feel that it's being constricted by race, and I think it's important to understand that a lot of people feel that their opportunities are being limited, irrespective of race, particularly now when we're dealing in the time of corporate restructuring mm-hmm. and downsizing. But in addition to that, there's a sense among a number of black professionals that they are being funneled in certain directions, that they are being denied even the opportunity to aspire to certain positions, that there is a glass ceiling of a sort. One of the things that's most interesting, I think, and that's also rather depressing about the careers of a lot of those who have even gone fairly far in corporate America is that most of them have tended to be limited to a few tracks, to what are considered black jobs, in the words of researcher Sharon Collins at the University of Illinois, who's done some research looking at a number of high-ranking professionals at Fortune 500 companies. And what she found was that well over half of them, I think something approaching 60 to 70% of these people, had risen through affirmative action type positions or risen through community affairs, public relations, community relations, positions which had nice titles, and in some cases vice presidencies, but had very little influence over the corporation and very little impact on the corporate bottom line, and from which it was very difficult to move anywhere else, and also positions that were peculiarly and particularly vulnerable in times of downsizing and in times of cutbacks. So what a lot of these black middle class people are saying, and these black professionals are saying, is that in addition to the whole set of frustrations that increasingly come with just being middle class in this country, there's another whole layer of frustrations which seem to come with being black in this country.
You write about identity troubles that face people in the black middle class at work. What kinds of troubles?
One of the interviews that I did was fascinating. It was with a black executive who was the senior vice president, human resources for a large corporation. And during the interview, he turns to me and he says, "Ellis, I discovered that in order to succeed, I needed to stop being black." And I looked at the guy who was quite dark-complected and didn't quite know what he was talking about. And he finally explained it. He said, well, what that means is that there were certain causes related to, say, civil rights and things of that nature, which I at one point used to either support or express sympathy for, which I just don't express any sympathy for anymore because I don't want to be thought of as basically as a black person. There are other people in the corporation who are black who he had decided he needed to keep his distance from because otherwise it would be thought that he was somehow coalescing with them and in opposition to the organization for which he worked. He just went through a lot of steps to, in effect, try to convince the people around him that whatever their stereotype was of a black person, he did not fit that. So that was his own specific way of coping, and that, of course, took a lot of psychological energy. The point that Teron Brown, one of the psychologists that I talked with, made was that black executives are just not permitted to even be angry. They are not permitted to be the kinds of bosses that a lot of white bosses are, who shout orders all the time and who are very demanding and domineering. If a black person has that style, that person does not succeed because all kinds of other messages are communicated that have racial components to them, mm-hmm. that make it very difficult for that person to be a success. All of a sudden, you have the image of the violent, angry black man, and that is not an image that will get you very far in corporate America.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ellis Coase, author of the new book, The Rage of a Privileged Class, Why Are Middle Class Blacks Angry and Why Should America Care? Ellis Coase is also a columnist and a contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ellis Coase, author of the new book, The Rage of a Privileged Class. You were interviewed by the late Robert Maxwell for an editorial job, editor of the editorial page at the New York Daily News. And you say that when he was interviewing you, he said, well, what statement would the news be making by hiring you for a top position here?
Right. At the time, I was being recruited, as you note, to be editorial page editor and editorial board chairman of the New York Daily News. And we had a very pleasant conversation for about 10 or 15 minutes talking about the newspaper and the news business and things that one executive would talk to a potential new executive about. But then he turned around and he looked at me and in very baronial tones said, well, what statement would we be making if we appointed you to be editor of the editorial pages here? What would we be saying to New York? And I knew what he wanted me to say. He wanted me to say something about a racial statement. And of course, I was not being hired for a racial job, so I had no inclination to do that. And I said, well, you would be saying that you were hiring a top-notch journalist to run your editorial operation. He said, yes, 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 but what would we really be saying to New York if we hired you? I said, well, you'd be saying you wanted to improve the quality of your editorial pages. Well, yes, 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 but what would we be saying to all of New York if we hired you? I said, well, you'd be saying you want a better newspaper, number one. He said, yes, yes, yes. He became very impatient. He said, well, would you be the highest-ranking black newspaper man in New York? And I said to him, well, maybe yes, maybe no. It all depends on what you think of titles, what, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I basically refused to play along. And he ultimately dropped the line of questioning. But what became very clear to me in that interview was that I was being treated in a way, and not necessarily disadvantageously, but I was being treated in a way that a white executive would never have been treated. And he was saying to me, if not in so many words, we want a racial symbol up here. Mm-hmm. And we think that you might be a very nice and appropriate racial symbol. And on one hand, that could be nice, I suppose, because I got the job, so it certainly didn't disqualify me from the job. But I think in the longer term, that kind of thinking can be very limiting, because if one is in fact hired to be a racial symbol, and then one is not necessarily hired to be an executive.
Right, right. Do you think he was saying, in a way, and if we hire you for this position, aren't we doing something special for your people?
Oh, sure. Sure, he wanted a response, I'm sure, that, oh, yes, you would be saying that you're really going to be progressive on racial issues and that you're really a right-thinking sort of individual and that you are making a huge statement that the New York Daily News now stands for racial progress or some such nonsense. And as I indicated, I just didn't want to play.
Right. Yeah. It seems to me this must be a hard subject to write about, because a lot of people assume, heck, the middle class, they have a good. What are they complaining about? They're middle class. They've got good jobs. The real problem in the African-American community are the people who are poor and who can't get out of poverty.
Sure. And I'm glad that you raised that point, Terry, because, in fact, that was exactly the reaction of Daniel Patrick Moynihan when I was talking with him about the book. He said, well, you know, the real problem is the problem of the underclass. And I don't disagree with that. I agree that there are some terribly, terribly pressing problems of simple survival in some cases, that affect people who are poor, that affect people who are poor of any color, and that certainly affect people who are poor and who are also black and who are in crumbling inner-city communities. No question about that. But by the same token, I don't think that simply because one set of people have problems, that means you ignore all the other problems in society, especially problems that are, in some respects, as racial problems are, linked. And I think that, moreover, we have in this country been sort of trapped in this kind of racial dialogue where we automatically assume that black equals poor equals ghetto equals uneducated equals a number of things which don't necessarily apply, because everyone doesn't fit that stereotype.
Some people, and you talk about this in the book, some people think that the problems of the urban black poor are so complex, so difficult, so out of reach to solve, that the real hope for the black underclass is the black middle class. The real
right.
hope is that the black middle class will do something to communicate, to become good role models, to do something to help solve the problem. What do you think about that?
I think it's a cop-out, but I think it also illuminates how separated many of us are, how separate many of us are, and talking about racial groups, and how segregated much of our thinking is. Because the fact of the matter is that many of the problems that the underclass, and not only the black underclass, there's also a white underclass, but many of the problems that the underclass face are problems that the black middle class really can't solve, certainly not by itself. You're talking about problems of job creation. You're talking about problems of urban infrastructure. You're talking about problems with the educational system. You're talking about problems of access to decent housing. These are problems that we have to deal with as a society. And I think that what has happened is that a lot of intellectuals, some black but most white, have kind of come to the conclusion that white people can't deal with these things. Let black professionals deal with them. If only the black professionals would go and get people in the ghetto to get good educations and to not commit crimes and to do all these other things which they believe that the people in the ghettos are doing. I think, as I said, I think that's a cop-out, because I think that the resources to accomplish a lot of the things we need to accomplish are resources that we have to harness as a country. And to the extent that Americans of any color wash their hands of these problems is to the extent that we just increase the gravity of these problems.
Jesse Jackson just held a conference called Stop the Violence and Save the Children.
Right.
And the conference focused a lot on crime within the black community, focusing on black people as victims of crime and black people as perpetrators of crime.
Mm-hmm.
You had a recent column in Newsweek about Jackson and his new campaign, and you said basically that he might be changing the direction of the civil rights movement.
Oh, I think it's an important issue. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not saying that these are issues that black civil rights groups and that black professional groups shouldn't grapple with. I think they, in fact, are. But I think the larger context in which we are operating is that we have, as a country, a problem with violence. It so happens that violence is a particularly pressing problem among blacks. But the crime problem is not just a black problem. Most whites who are killed in this country, upwards of 85% of whites who are killed by other whites in this country. So we as a country have a problem with violence.
Well, what Jackson said, and you quoted this in your column, was that things have changed from the days when the architects of violence and brutality were the enemies. Now homicide or fratricide and AIDS are the killers of black people. When you say that Jackson might be repositioning the civil rights movement, do you think that he's heading in an important direction by starting to focus more on crime?
Yes, I think he is. I think that a lot of people are very fearful these days because of the problem of violent crime, and that what has happened, or what happened in the past, was that civil rights organizations shied away from that issue.
You what?
They shied away from that issue because they thought it would be misused against them. They thought that if they got into the issue of law and order, they would be pulled into this sort of agenda of arrest more and more black men and put people in jail, throw away the keys kinds of thinking, and that this would be done to the exclusion of the other parts of the agenda that they thought were important, parts of the agenda having to do with investment in school systems or in urban areas. And so they were very reluctant to engage this set of issues, and as a result, they were vigorously engaged by the right wing and by conservatives. And I think now what the civil rights organizations have realized is that they can't really avoid these issues. So they're going to have to come to grips with them in some way. And the thing that they think that they can contribute that the conservatives don't contribute is also a concern about a lot of the social problems that tend to fuel violent crime.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Ellis Coase is the author of The Rage of a Privileged Class. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is in the Czech Republic today. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the president's trip on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report. The president's gone there to Prague to talk about the idea of partnership for peace involving Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. Also, Brooke Gladstone reports on the opening of the new Russian parliament. Much confusion reigned. A report from Canada on the reluctance of that country to accept the idea of airstrikes in Bosnia. Canada, of course, has hundreds of peacekeepers in Bosnia. The Department of Agriculture is moving ahead with a plan to have all meat carry warning labels, referring to food poisoning. And I'll be talking about the banning of sled dogs from Antarctica.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like a lot of city dwellers, commentator Maureen Carrigan has gotten along fine for most of her adult life without a car. But a recent trip to the auto show twisted her view.
According to the latest economic surveys, this past holiday season was a buying boom. Analysts say our consumer confidence is returning, but I could have told them that months ago. The first indication I had was back in July when my husband Rich came home one night with a bunch of car magazines. "What's with all these pictures of hot rods?" I asked him. He looked me in the eye and said, "I think we should buy a car." And even though I knew our savings account was flatter than fresh roadkill, Rich's inane consumer confidence was infectious, and I heard myself answer, "Yeah, I think we should buy a car too." So I began to read magazines like Motor Trend and Car Craft, and I discovered a literary forum where men still feel free to strut their stick shifts. Car magazines fall into two categories. The lowbrow kind always has a cover photo of a blonde in a thong bikini straddling an engine. The highbrow kind tastefully reserves the blondes and bikinis for the inside pages, next to ads for lots of he-men-type products. My favorite ad is for something called a car bra, one of those covers that goes over the front grill of the car and keeps dust off the headlights. Get it? Headlights? Car bra? But as I learned 2 weeks ago, the heavy octane testosterone of car magazines smells like perfume compared to the musk in the air at the auto show. By then, Rich had devolved into Mad Max the Road Warrior, and he claimed we had to go to see all the latest models. I only remembered that in car talk, models is a word that has two meanings. When we got to the show, where a stage was being set up for a performance of the Miller Beer Cold Patrol Girls, the Road Warrior got in line to sit in a Ferrari, so I walked around the auto show and saw it was ingeniously laid out to conform to the normative stages of a heterosexual male's car life cycle. Near the entrance was Babe World, where smiling young models stood next to Jags, Porsches, and Camaros, all of them spinning on huge turntables. Lots of guys stood around taking snapshots of this dream phenomenon. Next to Babe World was Commitment World, filled with family pods, Saabs, and Tauruses. A pit stop area divided the two worlds. The beer and Frankfurter huts were jammed. Nobody was near the cappuccino concession. As I walked around the auto show, I noticed how strangely quiet everybody was, like we were in a hushed cathedral of cars. The only sound that regularly broke the silence was the slam, slam, slamming of car doors, Mercedes doors, Corvette doors. I guess in lieu of driving or knowing anything about engines, it was the only way a lot of these guys could demonstrate their mastery. I found Rich, true to his innate chromosomal instincts, slamming the door of a car we were thinking of buying. A great rush of affection swelled up within me. "Wait," I told him as I slid behind the wheel of the car and popped open the trunk. A crowd of other guys gathered to watch as he slammed the trunk shut. "Solid as a fortress," one of them said. "Do it again," Rich called out. I sat there popping the trunk and thinking about how weird men are. And as I breathed in that new car smell and felt my new car fever rising, I had to squelch an overwhelming urge to jump out and kick the tires.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University.
I bought a brand new airmobile, custom made. It was a flight deal with a powerful motor and some hideaway wings. Pushing on the button and you will hear her sing. Now you can't get me, baby, you can't catch me. Cause if you get too close, you know I'm gone like a cool breeze.
Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Waving goodbye in a little old souped-up jitney. I put my foot in my tank and I began to roll. Moaning siren towards the state patrol. So I let out my wings and then I blew my horn. Bye-bye, New Jersey, I be come airborne. Now you can't get me,
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
President Clinton is in Europe this week, dealing with the future of NATO and the war in Bosnia. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the changing face of Europe with Timothy Garton Ash, author of In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.